The coronavirus outbreak is testing public health preparations and our president's ability to give the public accurate information.
Anybody that wants a test can get a test.
That's simply not true. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News.
We trust in a matter of weeks, the coronavirus tests will be broadly available to the public.
And many of those test kits will head west to Washington State, the current epicenter of the outbreak in the U.S. But the virus is spreading.
In Europe, new cases have doubled over the past 3 days to over 7,000, and the response varies from country to country.
We've got the latest on the coronavirus here and abroad, so stay with us. We'll give you the news you need to start your weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Chobani Oat. Made to taste just like milk, it's creamy, frothy, and great with coffee and cookies. But without the dairy, because it's not milk, it's almost milk. New Chobani Oat. Support also comes from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in issues including depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit BetterHelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
There are now more than 300 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the U.S., and states are grappling with its spread.
Florida officials say that two people who tested positive there have died, the first deaths from the outbreak on the East Coast.
On the West Coast, 21 people aboard a cruise ship off the coast of California have the disease caused by the virus, and Washington State is taking more measures to contain the illness. That state has confirmed more than 80 cases and 14 deaths, the highest numbers in the country.
Will Stone of member station KNKX in Seattle has been covering the story. Will, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And what is the situation like in Seattle?
Well, every day brings a batch of new confirmed cases, especially in the last few days. The numbers have jumped significantly, as well as the deaths being reported. And these aren't just confined to a few hotspots. They're popping up really all throughout the metro area among staff at the University of Washington or at Amazon and Starbucks, hospital workers, and even in rural communities 3 hours away from the coast in the middle of the state.
What do public officials there say about the increasing number of cases?
They're issuing very strong warnings and asking people to reconsider their plans. We have emergency declarations in cities. Schools are shutting down. The university has canceled in-person classes. Festivals are being canceled. Even employees at major tech companies are being told to work from home. And even the Comic-Con event was postponed after they said they were going to continue with it. They ended up calling it off. Generally, the public is being asked to avoid large gatherings. And there is recognition among public health leaders that all we can do now is try to mitigate the damage. This is how Dow Constantine, executive of King County, puts it.
We must prepare this region for the inevitable continued spread of this virus, at least in the short run. But we will do everything we can to slow its spread, to protect those who are most likely to become seriously ill from it.
And Constantine made these comments as he fielded questions about a nursing home called Life Care Center, where the virus has swept through, leaving many residents ill and killing some.
How are people in Seattle coping?
Many are adjusting their day-to-day routines, whether that's working at home or not going to yoga class or to restaurants. It's not a ghost town yet, but there is a noticeable difference in people riding public transit and at the airport. And those who are at high risk, which is defined as people over 60 or with underlying health conditions or pregnant, they're having to preemptively isolate themselves. One such person is Morgan Larson. She's 29 years old, works at a hospital, and she has multiple sclerosis. She was reluctant at first to just stay home.
So I kept making excuses why I should be going to work. But at the end of the day, this is a very serious matter. And especially in King County, we're just taking the highest precaution as we can.
And for Larson, that means her doctor has advised her to stay home until March 23rd.
Will, you've been covering the outbreak as it develops all over the West Coast. What's the latest about that cruise ship off of San Francisco?
Vice President Mike Pence announced yesterday that nearly half the people tested aboard the Grand Princess, a cruise ship being held off San Francisco, have been infected with coronavirus. 21 out of 46 people tested. 19 were crew members and 2 were passengers. There are about 3,500 people on board the ship. The vice president said it would be brought to a non-commercial port this weekend where testing would continue. And this is, of course, the second cruise ship to be affected by the coronavirus outbreak.
Will Stone of member station KNKX in Seattle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The coronavirus outbreak is testing President Trump and his administration.
Yesterday, he visited with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is working to try to contain the outbreak. He also surveyed tornado damage in Tennessee.
How he handles crises and disasters like these could come to define his presidency, like many presidents before him.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith traveled with the president now and joins us from Florida, where he's spending the weekend. Tam, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Tell us first about Tennessee, where presidents, following events like that, presidents are often asked to be the consoler in chief.
Right. President Trump visited a street that was just a tangle of demolished houses, trees, and cars. It was devastated by the tornadoes that came through on Monday night, in the middle of the night. On the street he visited, 8 people had died on just that one small block. I asked President Trump what his message was for the people who live in Tennessee.
Well, I do have a message, and I have a message for the families of those that lost their lives. And we love them. They're special people. It's an incredible place, incredible state, a tremendous heart. Already you see people rebuilding.
A tornado is contained. You know, the scary part is over. There's no unknown. He can sign a disaster declaration, as he did, send federal help, and all that's left is the recovery, the rebuilding, and he can be sort of the cheerleader.
And, of course, very different situation for the second part of his trip, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is trying to marshal the response to coronavirus. What stood out to you about that trip?
Well, that whole trip was sort of symbolic of how this administration is struggling to deal with a very fluid situation. Whether President Trump would even go to the CDC was up in the air, on again, off again throughout the morning. And then as President Trump talked about it, he was asked about the cruise ship off the coast, and he was very focused on his own numbers, on his ratings, and on how the cruise ship passengers could make him look.
They would like to have the people come off. I'd rather have the people stay, but I'd go with them. I told them to make the final decision. I would rather, because I like the numbers being where they are. I don't need to have the numbers double because of one ship.
Now, of course, the president did leave it to the vice president and the coronavirus task force, and those people are being brought off. But unlike the tornado, coronavirus is a challenge that is literally not contained, and President Trump seems to be struggling with that.
Tam, how was this trip emblematic of how Trump deals with crisis situations?
You know, he does want to accentuate the positive. In this case, he's accentuating the positive in the face of something that is very much unknown and that is already in some areas like Seattle causing massive disruption. And he simply says things that aren't true as part of his accentuation of the positive, as part of his effort to tell a story that is a positive one.
As of right now and yesterday, anybody that needs a test, that's the important thing. And the tests are all perfect. Like the letter was perfect. The transcription was perfect, right? This was not as perfect as that, but pretty good.
And to be clear, it is not perfect, and the tests are not readily available yet. There have been delays in getting them out. There are still problems and delays, and not everyone can get a test. And as for the transcription, that call led to the president's impeachment.
Trump announced last night that Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House chief of staff, is out of that job. Mark Meadows, the congressman from North Carolina, is in. What kind of effect does this might have on the administration's response?
I mean, the timing is puzzling, given that the president and the White House are in the midst of dealing with a very big problem with coronavirus. But Mark Meadows, the congressman, has been in President Trump's ear, has spoken to him multiple times a week for much of his presidency, and is a strong ally. So the president is excited about this change.
And NPR White House correspondent Tamara Key, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And be sure to check out the NPR Politics podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. More than 90 countries have reported cases of the coronavirus. There are more than 100,000 cases worldwide.
Well, the infection rate is slowing in China, where the outbreak began in December. Europe is being hard hit. Italy has the highest infection rate after China. Germany and Spain are reporting more infections. The rate is doubling nearly every day in France.
And we now go to NPR's Paris correspondent to tell us more, Eleanor Beardsley. Eleanor, good morning.
Good morning, Lulu.
What is the situation there in France?
Well, people are worried, but I wouldn't say panicked. People have confidence in the French healthcare system. There are hotlines to call if you feel you have the symptoms. Still people out in the streets, though fewer people in movie theaters. 2 weeks ago, French officials said there were zero active cases and 18 people had recovered. Today, there are more than 600. So it's been jumping almost 200 a day in the last few days. Last night, the prime minister announced that they were closing schools in one region, and that's something the government said it was not going to do. The French government has taken over the supply of the country's 4 mask-making factories, so these are for health professionals only. I was in a pharmacy yesterday, and a woman wanted to buy a mask, and she was not happy when the pharmacist said, no, you need a prescription to get one. And the government has also frozen the price of the sanitizing hand gel. Gatherings of over 5,000 people have been canceled. Events have been canceled. Tourism is plummeting. I mean, March is a dead month. Now people are wondering how long this will go on and if huge events like maybe the Cannes Film Festival in May are going to be canceled. President Emmanuel Macron warned that France needs to prepare for level 3 of the outbreak. France is currently in level 2. Level 3 means when they can no longer trace the transmission of the disease and it's just spreading on its own.
What about in the rest of Europe? I mean, what are we seeing there?
Well, Italy, there are more than 4,000 cases, the highest outside of Asia. And, you know, there's sort of a psychosis gripping the country. Everyone across Italy tunes in for the 6 p.m. Civil Protection Agency, you know, broadcast on television to keep track of the numbers. Most of the cases are in the north, but even Rome is a ghost town. People are staying off the streets. Tourists are staying away. There haven't been any deaths yet in Germany, but there's more than 600 cases, and the health minister is urging people to remain calm and the media to act responsibly, like not to film empty shelves when they know they're going to be restocked. But the outbreak is really, you know, showing vulnerabilities in the country's decentralized healthcare system, where each state has its own hotline and networks, and they don't seem to be talking to each other well. Britain's National Health Service was overstretched before this, and health officials are just hoping to get past the flu season so that they can deal with this. And Spain has 400 cases. They're worried about tourism. You know, Easter, Semana Santa is coming up. People will be canceling.
All these countries have some version of a national health system. So how are we seeing those systems coping?
Well, Lulu, no one talks about money. I mean, yes, they all have healthcare systems. Money's not an issue. People do not talk about whether their tests will be paid for or their treatment. I haven't even heard it brought up. But like everywhere, there aren't enough kits, so health officials are having to select who is tested now. Hospital beds are also a problem. And, you know, we say again, coronavirus is spreading at the same time as the winter flu virus, and it's the same symptoms. I spoke yesterday with the head of the infectious disease unit at a Paris hospital, and he said that was making it very difficult. Here is Dr. Eric Combe.
The most important point is to slow the development of the outbreak, unless you think that you are able to face the tsunami wave of the outbreak, which is probably impossible for most of the healthcare system everywhere in the world.
I will add that European officials say they are against closing borders and locking down towns like what was done in China. They say it won't help.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lulu.
And that's up first for Saturday, March 7th, 2020.
Our podcast is produced and edited by a mighty crew: Hiba Ahmad, Samantha Balaban, Sophia Boyd, Melissa Gray, Denise Guerra, Ed McNulty, Dee Parvaz, and Jan Stewart.
In the studio, there's more Might, with director Ned Wharton and engineer Stu Rushfield, Patrick Boyd, and Jay Sibbs.
Evie Stone is our supervising editor and keeping us all in line, executive producer Sarah Oliver.
And there's Jim Kane, our deputy managing editor. Sometimes he brings treats, but they're out before I can get to them. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro. Up First is back Monday with news to start your week. And follow us, please, on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And of course, you know, the news doesn't stop when this podcast is over. We have a solution for that. Weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday.
Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting,
One scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.